Hi, and welcome to the Vancouver Life Podcast.
This podcast is created to answer the most talked about questions when it comes to navigating the Vancouver real estate market.
I'm your host, Dan Wortel, a licensed agent and accredited real estate investment advisor based here in Vancouver, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ryan Dash.
Hi, Dan. I'm also a local realtor, an exhausted father of two, husband of one, and really happy to be here.
Let's get right into today's episode. We have an absolutely jam-packed episode for you this week, including a look into the recently released CMHC report, which indicates and predicts that home prices in Vancouver could hit $2.3 million in just the next 6 years. On top of that, we also saw inflation rise in the US. We're going to talk about how that's going to affect the real estate market and if you should expect inflation to also rise here in Canada. Has there been any reprieve for the renters out there? Afraid not. Rental rates nationally have hit another all-time high, which we're going to talk about. Meanwhile, credit card debt has also hit a new all-time high. So all that and more, what's going on with housing? Well, inventory is finally spiking while prices are dropping. So it's all kind of coming to a head these days. So buckle up. There's a lot going on and we're going to analyze all of it because there are some fast changing times ahead. And real quick, everyone, for anybody that's new to this channel, well, Ryan and I, we run a team of realtors here in Vancouver, BC, and we take a look at all the information, data, news, and everything that happens every week, filter it down to what we feel is the most important, compare it to the real world events that we're feeling every single day within our business, and share our experiences that we're seeing, and then share all of that with our audience. So we never run ads on this channel, and the only ask we have is that you are enjoying what you are hearing. Please share it with someone else who might enjoy it too. Okay, let's get into what happened this week. First off, the CMHC report has been updated, and this is obviously Canada's top housing agency, right? This is the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation. This is a crown government-owned company here. And basically, they predict that Canada will be short up to 4 million houses by the year 2030, right? They look at where we are today with the amount of houses available for the amount of people that exist, and then basically look at how many houses are under construction, and of course, what the immigration and population growth numbers and targets are looking like. And basically, they said, look, we're going to be about 4 million homes short by the next 6-7 years here. And the result of that, of course, when we look at just simple supply and demand, is that, well, if you have more demand than supply, that typically has upward pressure on prices. And they predict nationally, home prices will increase by 89% by the year 2030. That's just 6 and a quarter years away. In British Columbia, that's even higher. A 90% appreciation rate by 2030. That would put home prices at $2,295,000 average. So obviously predicting prices 6 years out is incredibly hard to do. And who knows if this is right or wrong, but let's also face a bit of the reality here that the prediction of housing shortages, I feel, is a lot more accurate. Because that's a very slow moving segment of the marketplace. And they have the data today. We know that, you know, from concept to handing over keys of a property, that's a minimum of what, 18 months minimum. And it could be 6 to 10 years for some of these larger buildings, right? I was at a pre-sale announcement the other day and that building is completing in 2030. Okay, at the same time that this housing number predictions are out there, and also why some people who buy into pre-sales think, hey, if the numbers are going to increase, having my capital tied up for that time frame may work out to my advantage. Why? Because, well, if CMHC is correct, the average home price in BC, or Vancouver rather, would grow by $181,000 per year. So, you know, if that actually were to come true, could you imagine anyone trying to save to get into the market while the runaway prices are taking off at 181K per year? It's almost impossible to save at a higher rate than that, making it advantageous to quote unquote wait. Again, we're just sharing news here. Take it for what it's worth, but you get the idea here. So we know that housing permit or building permit applications are at 20-year lows here. We know we've got record immigration. And so some of these predictions, at least as far as the housing shortage, I think could be very accurate. pricing, we'll see. But hey, again, simple supply and demand economics say when there's a heck of a lot more demand than there is supply, that will almost always guarantee upward pressure in prices. Ryan, love to hear your take on this too.
How do you build 4 million homes in that kind of time frame? We might have the materials here, but we certainly don't have the labor. We certainly don't have the know-how to build that vast amount of construction. And that's across the nation too, right? So there's some areas across the nation that could handle a much higher load of homes, and there's other parts of the nation that would have a very tough time meeting any of these quotas. Furthermore, I think, you know, in order for this to actually happen, you're going to need to see a tremendous amount of political reform. We have too much bureaucratic red tape to build anything. I mean, in Vancouver, it takes like 6 years to build a tower, 6 years to build 400 homes, right? That has to change. And that has to change now. It can't change later. And if we're ever going to catch up to affordability, it's, you know, the numbers that you were talking about, Dan, it's beyond crisis level, right? People cannot save $181,000 a year to keep up with what it will be the future price of homes. So it's, I think, first of all, don't rely on the government to bail you out, right? That's kind of how I feel about this. Now, CMHC has been wrong before, but that being said, I think there's some overwhelming economic factors that point to the fact that you need to do something about this if you want to own a home here, right? So I would get aggressive, try and figure out what's going on, understand that potentially the interest rate scenario we're in right now is temporary. The only other maybe thing I would say to this is that if prices continue to go in that direction and they continue to become so unaffordable, I think you'll actually see immigration levels peel right off. It'll become really difficult to live here. And people won't move here. They'll go to a different place where they can make more money or where they can get in cheaper. So it's a real problem and it's a double-edged sword. If it doesn't get dealt with, we might have a different set of problems that we're not accustomed to in the future. So I don't know how it's going to play out entirely. Like you said, Dan, 6 years is quite a trajectory from where we are now. But if we don't start having, you know, major political reform, which allows us to build homes faster without sacrificing the quality of that construction, I don't know how we keep prices moderate if immigration continues at its current pace, right? So,
yeah. Real quick, too, though, let's also look at the other side of that coin where current homeowners are looking at that going, oh, heck yeah. If you're going to build my equity at 180K per year, have at her. You know what I mean? But again, that's just looking at the other side there. So again, some people are going to love this news. Some people are going to absolutely hate it. And there's going to be a whole mix in between.
It'll be like, and renting a home in Vancouver will be like renting a home in San Francisco. It'll be $4,500 a month for a studio. Right. And that's insanity. And look what's happening there. It's not going well. Right. So there has to be some sustainability here. You know, prices just can't go up forever. They need to moderate to some degree and they have to be in line with the rest of the economy. So it's a tall task, but I think at the end of the day, this has largely been ignored by politicians because they want, you know, what makes them popular tomorrow, not what's going to make them popular 10 years from now. And we need someone who's going to recognize that.
Yeah. I think too, one more thing here that I skipped over. One thing that we should point out too is like 89%, 90%. It's obviously a massive number. And is that even possible? I mean, let's look at the last 6 years of Vancouver price appreciation for reference, and it's only up 15% since 6 years ago. But if we go back a little further, there was a time between 2010 and 2016 where prices actually increased by 84%. So it's not completely out of the wheelhouse for this type of prediction to happen because we've almost seen it happen before. It's a massive number. It would basically be a record-setting number. But again, how often have we said record-setting and all-time highs on this channel? I mean, it's every week in some form or another.
In if you look at the data in the States too, you'll see numbers like that as well, right? So it's not, it has happened before, but I guess what I'm saying is I think the rest of the economy has to move with it, in order for that to take place, right? So that's the hard part. And I don't know if that's going to happen. We'll see. We'll see. And maybe speaking to some of that, and we'll change a little bit of gears here because we'll touch on U.S. inflation. So the consumer price index increased by 0.6% last month. That is the largest gain since June of 2022. In the last 12 months through August, the inflation rate jumped to 3.7% after climbing to 3.2% in July. Economists expected inflation to hit 3.6%, so 3.7% wasn't a huge surprise. I don't think that that changes the forecast for rate increases in the States. I think financial markets overwhelmingly, from what I've looked at, are overwhelmingly expect the policy rate to stay unchanged for the time being. However, there's some things that are kind of popping up down in the States that could produce some more supply chain issues. You've got an announcement here where auto workers, they have announced they're going to strike. This could disrupt supply chains and push prices on vehicles. The United Auto Workers member last month voted overwhelmingly in favor of authorizing a work stoppage for General Motors, Ford Motor Co. and Stellantis. So that could have following cars here too. I mean, the prices of cars have been bananas over the last 2 years, and a really kind of interesting indicator in terms of, you know, we're not completely out of the supply chain bottleneck just yet.
Got it. So now, September the 19th, next week, we've got an inflation announcement for Canada. So follow that one. We'll see what happens here. It is, I believe, predicted to go up again. I don't think it's to the tune of 0.6%, but I would not be surprised of a 0.2, 0.3% increase in our inflation here because while rates are high, we are coming off of some base effects. So it is looking to head north a little bit again, even in the high interest rate environment that we're living in. But hey, let's have a look at maybe why they won't raise interest rates, even if we do see inflation start to tick up here. Because we're going to dive into GDP now and, you know, a bit of a dry subject, but it's the economy. It's the health of the economy. So it's important to get a fairly good understanding of it. So we got a couple of key points here to share with you. That when we look at the last three quarters of GDP announcements, two of those quarters showed a drop, right? So the gross domestic product is dropping within Canada here. And it's a real sign that basically these interest rate hikes are taking effect, right? The goal here is to literally slow the economy. And now the data is showing that that has happened. On top of this, we've got like household spending hit the lowest number we've seen in 2 years here. And residential investment has fallen for five straight quarters. That's obviously anything to do with like construction, people buying houses, interest payments, that type of thing. So even though it's dropped for five straight quarters, we're basically back to where we were pre-COVID. So we've kind of hit that long-term average, if you will. But an unintended consequence is also taking place here. And that's new home construction, where we just saw that fall 8.2%. I believe that's year over year here. So a high interest rate environment, what we're really recognizing here is it puts buyers on hold, it puts sellers on hold, but it also puts builders on hold. So it's a market freeze out there, right? We've talked about how building permits are at 20-year lows. We've talked about how sales volumes are, you know, 20-year or 15-year, whatever, about 15, 20% below that 10-year average. So everything's really kind of slow right now. And of course, what's happening behind that, though, is demand. So we've talked about all these people that are coming into the country and all these people that technically want to buy. And trust me, from our team of seven agents, we know how many buyers out there want to buy. And they are pre-qualified. They're ready to go. But they just don't like what's out there because there's no great inventory because all these sellers are stuck in their homes. So anyway, it's a bit of a freeze still going on here. And a bit of the bigger takeaway is that the economy is seeing declining growth on a per capita basis, per capita, because it's really only this massive population boom that's keeping us out of a formal recession, though some argue, including ourselves in our last episode, that we are basically already in a recession here. But regardless, any like real growth in GDP that we've been hearing about over the past decade or so has been essentially masked, covered up by this huge population and immigration growth. Because when we look at the per capita household consumption and per capita GDP, those are falling at an annual rate so extreme that we've only seen it three times before, including 08, the global financial crisis, 1991, and 1982. And if you were around for those were very tough economic and financial times. And we're seeing the per capita GDP rate falling at a similar rate to those three times. Basically, huge indicators of a potential deep recession coming our way. So now, I guess that makes the question being like, what type of quote unquote landing should we expect? Is it a hard landing, a soft landing, a non-landing? And what does that even mean? Well, you know, I think anything in the sort of hard landing would be a deep recession and would be felt for a long time, right? There's no two recessions are the same, and you can have a soft one and you can have a very hard one, and you can have a short one and you can have a prolonged one. So we don't know where this is going to head yet, but so many of these indicators are pointing towards deeper and longer as far as the recession or pending recession could really be. Because ultimately, I think the damage has already been done. In the sense that these high rates, we're seeing high interest rates, we're seeing the damage come across all the data now, and it's lagging data too, right? So if we keep rates high, if the Bank of Canada keeps rates long, it's really going to only exacerbate the outcome. It'll only make the recession deeper and longer, you know? So how much of this damage needs to hit the headlines before rates start coming back down? We're already having pressure, right? We've already got our premier reaching out. We got Ontario's premier reaching out saying, at least don't raise rates anymore, which they ultimately did not. But what's the next letter? Please drop rates, probably, right? We'll see how that goes, but you get the idea here. When we talk about lagging data and we talk about the Bank of Canada taking their sweet time before they do anything, remember that inflation, while it's the BOC's mandate to keep it below 3%, it hit 6% before they even started raising rates in the last rate hiking cycle. So they were way behind the eight ball in a sense on the way up. So they probably will be on the way down as well. So quick moves are not something to hold your breath for. We're going to see how this pans out, but a lot of moving targets. And realistically, they being the BOC and the government, they may look back at where we are today and say, uh-oh, we probably should have started reducing rates then. And, you know, we'll talk about this in 6 months or so when they actually start, but lots of moving pieces that change every week. That's kind of my insight into GDP for today.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting too, because when we look at, because, you know, at our group here, we look at commercial real estate and, you know, industrial real estate and residential real estate. And when you look at what's happening in, say, the industrial space, for example, you've got businesses that were hiring that are now either moderating that hiring or they are actually going into survival mode, right? So you're starting to see leases that would have renewed at, say, $22 or $23 a foot that are now renewing at $20 or $19 or $18 a square foot. Companies that were expanding are no longer expanding. And that will have a ripple effect through not only the job market, but also through the commercial, industrial, and eventually the residential real estate market as people's incomes get, you know, they won't rise with inflation, right? So I also think we need to pay really close attention to the jobs reports that come out here. That is the, you know, the other side of this equation. And if they continue to drop, then, you know, the recession could be far worse than maybe we're anticipating here. And, you know, with GDP continuing its contraction-based trajectory, you could, you know, look at the rate hike expectations to change dramatically with that. The end result of the weaker-than-expected GDP print, you know, more or less puts rate hike expectations all but collapsed. Markets were pricing in almost 100% chance of another 0.25% rate hike by the end of the year. That's now dropped to about 40%. So markets are, the narrative is kind of changing here. We're starting to see people talking about the top of the rate hike cycle. Maybe we're at that point now. We'll see. That can all change, obviously, if we get some other unexpected change to the economy, or, you know, the COVID outbreaks that we're seeing right now become so great that they start to shut down economic activity. I hope not, but we never know. So nevertheless, you know, as long as inflation doesn't continue to creep up, you know, to more or higher levels than are expected, I think this is an overall positive development, so much as that, you know, we don't want to see more rate hikes. But, you know, kind of like we talked about, what does that mean for a recession on the other side? So what are we in for? It's hard to say, although I would venture to say that we are already at the beginning stages of this.
And this is obviously trickling through to the housing markets. And we do like to take a national look at different marketplaces. Obviously, what happens in Toronto quite often can emulate Vancouver within a couple of months. These trends we see are quite related. So let's talk about Toronto for a minute here, where we saw last month sales drop about 19%. Over the last 3 months, sales have dropped 19%. This is taking their sales volume numbers down to levels not seen since the 90s. So it's very slow over in Ontario and especially Toronto as well. And you could imagine sales volumes in the 90s. Well, guess what? There's a few more people that live in Toronto today than there were in the 90s. And yet they're seeing similar sales volumes overall there, right? Not adjusted for population growth. They are seeing new listings jump finally as well, because Toronto has been short of new or overall inventory as well. But again, they're barely back to sort of the long-term norms. And this is, though, a bit of a reprieve, because they've been sitting at like 30-year lows in active inventory for most of 2023. So what did it do? Well, it spiked about 30% between May and August. And that's a big number, to the tune of like it's only been seen once before in the last 30 years. And that was in 2020. And that was obviously probably coming right out of COVID. So realistically, this is almost a once in a lifetime spike in inventory. So they're finally seeing that increase. Where it goes from here will be interesting, because like I said, we're at long-term norms. So we're up 16% year over year in total inventory. And what's interesting is Vancouver still, at least up until last month, because I got some interesting data coming soon here. But as of last month, Vancouver had dropped 11% year over year. So, I mean, you're looking at like a 27% change in inventory year over year on a percentage basis comparatively. So very interesting that those two markets have somewhat detached from each other as far as behaviors go. But similar to Vancouver, Toronto's HPI, their prices dropped for the first time in a while, for the first time in 6 months. And Vancouver saw prices drop for the first time in 8 months. Are there homes coming? Well, actually, yes, there are, because in Toronto, under construction homes increased almost 10% over the last 4 months. And that's driven almost entirely by the condo segment, which is up over 11% during that same time frame. Unfortunately, as we know, building permits are on the way down. Okay, so the permits for future builds are down, but under construction is increasing. And this is, of course, because or coming from people, developers who had put a plan in place years ago that are now committed to that plan. They've got financing, et cetera. So they're moving forward with their projects. Either way, we need them now, but that long-term issue is always kind of looming here. So a quick note on Vancouver's inventory. We're actually up 11% in just the first two weeks of September here, increasing our overall active listings to 11,000. Okay, this is the highest we've seen in about 14, 15 months. We could possibly, at this trajectory, end the month of September at a 3-year high in active listings. Hooray, they're finally coming. So I don't know if you are seriously considering buying, or if you've been an active buyer, but you've been frustrated about not seeing the home that you like out there, maybe have another look this week, because there's finally, again, another 1,100 active listings this week that there weren't 2 weeks ago. So check that out.
It kind of speaks to what we talked about in the last pod, which is, you know, various different housing sectors. So let's talk about condos, townhomes, and homes, single family homes, are kind of all operating in different metrics, right? Like we talked about last week, the sales to active ratio, meaning whether you're in a seller's market or a buyer's market, for townhomes and condos was well into a seller's market. Where we're seeing a lot of that malleable change in price is in that single family realm. So if you're making that move up, or you were targeting a move to a single family home, now is a good time to do that, because you can take advantage of the affordability crisis in so much as that you have a townhome, which has a bigger pool of buyers, and you can go after that single family home and maybe get a much better deal than you would, say, in 6 or 9 months from now when things change dramatically. So with that said, unfortunately, I'm not done talking about Toronto here, because there's still some scary data out there that people should be made aware of. So when it comes to the presale market in Toronto, there are around 80,000 condos that are currently under construction. Approximately 80% of them, or 65,000 condos, have been bought by investors. It's estimated that when those come to completion, many of them will face large cash calls and they won't be able to qualify for the financing because they didn't secure it when they actually purchased the condo some 2-3 years ago. So that could be somewhere to the tune of 30,000 distressed condos completing in the next 24 months. That's a great opportunity if you're a buyer to scoop up a good deal with a potential sudden but short supply glut that you could take advantage of. When we look at Vancouver by comparison here, it's somewhat similar to Toronto. Vancouver dwellings under construction are up 15% in the last 4 months, which will bring some sense of relief. But again, it'll be a very short window. With that said, though, after that, there's not a lot coming, because permits right now are at 20-year lows. And it kind of goes back to the point we've stressed on so many times speaking on the pod, that we need to alleviate builders so they can bring back supply. Listen, when you raise interest rates, right, the whole point is to kill demand so supply can return. But if the people producing the supply don't build because they can't afford it, then we don't solve the problem. We just create intermittent pain and we slow down the economic growth of the country. So unless we figure out, again, some kind of political reform where builders can continue to build and they get a tax break, maybe we look at GST. I mean, even the rental increase amount that just happened here was because builders were not building rental purpose built buildings because the rent controls are too too stiff, right? So they needed to increase it by 1.5% just to get developers to get interested in those projects again. So it's kind of gone a little bit too far. We need political reform. We need to build this stuff faster, and they can't be subjected to the same economic constraints if we want supply to catch up with demand.
Well, maybe the government's listening, Ryan, because we're recording this on Thursday, about 10 a.m. here, and there's a headline that just came out this morning, just before we recorded this, saying that the federal government will eliminate GST on the construction of new rental apartments immediately, in an effort to make housing more affordable. So details are not out yet. They'll be out this afternoon, well before this pod is released. So hopefully it's thorough and thought out. But, you know, we've touched on this many times. There's upwards of 32% of all new homes are tax, right? If you buy $1 million house, 300 odd thousand of that is just going towards taxes. So this is a great step in the right direction. They are reducing that by about 5%. So if you take 30% of your costs and you reduce that down to 25%, that helps. And this is for rental apartments, right? So they're not incentivizing builders for end users. This is only, my understanding, incentivizing builders for rental apartments, which, as we know, are equally as needed. So big step in the right direction here. We'll see where this pans out. But again, this is positive. This is something. This is incentivizing builders, which we've talked about being the probably largest shift that needs to take place in order to help inventory. But let's expand here on renters and rental rates and of course, landlords, because this week on September 11th, BC government moved for the fifth time in 6 years to limit the maximum allowable rent increase below the level set out by the government's own standards, right? So what they've done is says that there's a cap for 2024 that landlords can only increase their rental rates by 3.5%. The guidelines state that rent increases should equate the rate of annual inflation, which would equal 5.6%. Okay, so the government's essentially obviously incentivizing renters here, trying to help renters out. And they've ultimately detached from their own rule basically since COVID, because back in 2021, landlords were not allowed to increase rents at all, 0%. And then in 2022, inflation hit 6.9% on average, yet rents were capped at a 1.5% increase. We saw that again last year. Inflation in 2023 averaged 5.8%, yet rents were only capped at 2%. So it's apparent that obviously the government is trying to do their best at helping renters keep rents below the rate of inflation. But that in turn, right, there's always another side to this, that in turn obviously hurts the housing providers, because guess what? Their expenses have gone up at that rate of inflation. So if you are a landlord, you're a housing provider, and your expenses are going up, but you can't help cover those expenses because the government's saying your tenant doesn't have to increase their payments. So this is a de-incentive for landlords, or de-incentivizes landlords from providing housing. So why would you want to be an investor here in basically BC, if the government is saying we're changing the rules so that you will have a hard time being cash positive? And so while we desperately need more and more rental units, government is basically saying the private market, like, you know, why don't you just go put your money elsewhere where there are no limits to how much you can earn? Do you know what I mean? If there's no stock out there that says, oh, no, you can only get 10% a year, anything more than that, we're going to keep, or whatever the case may be. So understandably, some investors that wanted to help with the housing market say, you know what? I'm not as interested because I got a cap on how much I can actually earn here. And it's not all about earning. But again, people aren't going to go and provide housing if they're guaranteed to lose money, typically. So even with all these dramatically reduced rental caps, the current rental rate in BC is at an all-time high, right? So who are these caps actually helping? Well, obviously existing renters, right? These people who go into the rental unit and they stay there for years and years and years. But here's the thing. What if these renters need more space? Maybe they're now, you know, somebody had a studio or a one bed and now they're a couple, or maybe they've got a baby on the way or a second baby on the way. Well, just like homeowners, a lot of tenants, a lot of renters are ultimately locked into their own unit, because the moment they move, they're now going to be, well, pushed into a market where they're paying not only market rents, but they're fighting for that unit. It's not a great landscape for them. You know, I've got friends here that, you know, they're in one beds for like $1,300 a month in downtown Vancouver. And they know that if they move, they're suddenly at $2,600. Their overhead, their rate, their housing expense doubles overnight. So they don't want to move. And their places, you know, maybe they like it, but they have had some ideas about moving and they can't. They can't. So that market is going to be continually tight for all these people that are in the houses. And yes, they're enjoying the lower increase in rates, and that's awesome for them. But again, you just got to understand the consequences that also come with this.
I think so, too. Dan, if I could just interject for a sec.
What's that?
I just want to add to that. I think a lot of people, for whatever reason, don't understand that creating rental units is a partnership between private industry and the government, right? You can't have one without the other. The government can't build the houses that its population needs. It needs to enter into partnership with private developers to create that. And if rental rates are capped, the inventory for renters is going to dwindle dramatically, because those developers participate in private industry. Right? So they will go to a different market where they can build what they want, or where they can build what matches their incentive and what they're trying to achieve. So unless there's a partnership, unless it coexists together, rental caps on average, more often than not, create a bigger problem overall, and much bigger problems longer term, than if we were to get rid of them and allow developers to bring a supply to the marketplace. Again, we restrict supply by doing this, because we de-incentivize, as you said, people from actually bringing the very needed supply to the marketplace. There's no incentive around it. So why would a private industry, why would a private company do that? They wouldn't take it on. Their job is to maximize whatever it is they're trying to do. So, you know, it's really kind of fundamentally broken. Again, more reform needs to take place around this. So I just needed to say that so that it provides context for people.
Yeah, I mean, look at it. The provinces that have rental caps also have the highest rental rates.
There you go.
You know, that speaks a lot to it. So the August numbers are out nationally. And yes, rental rates across Canada have hit a new all-time high, now sitting at $2,117 on average. And of course, for reference here, if we look at the recent cycle low, that took place back in May of 2021, where the average national rental rate was $1,675. So in just over 2 years, we have seen the average national rent increase by 26%, or about $450 per month. And not to laugh at this, but our rental rates are so high right now that if you go to the Canada Immigration website, it is now warning potential immigrants about our housing crisis, stating verbatim, you will likely pay at least $350 a month to rent a room. You can pay at least $2,000 a month to rent a larger apartment or large house. So at least they are setting up anybody who's thinking about coming to the country, setting up a bit of an expectation into at least what they can expect in the rental market out there.
You can find me a house for $2,000 a month. I might sell mine. That being said, let's look at Calgary, because maybe the hope for people who are immigrating to Canada, assuming maybe there should be a warning about, you know, minus 40 degree winters in Calgary. But that being said, Calgary is becoming the darling of Canadian real estate. Sales have jumped, for example, 4% month over month and posted the strongest August ever on record. It moved 3,500 units. By comparison, Vancouver, which is almost twice the size of Calgary, you know, Calgary's got 1.4 million. Vancouver's got 2.5 million people. Vancouver just did 2,300 units. Calgary did 3,500, right? Sales are mostly condos. They're up 65% year over year. And inventory there is truly at rock bottom. It's down 34% year over year. That's the lowest in over a decade, by a significant margin, right? So prices are up 20% year over year in Calgary. They're now just over $550,000 on average. And that is due in large part to, just like we talked about, population growth, but also interprovincial migration. So people from Toronto, Ontario, and BC, for example, in these really expensive markets where your average cost of a home is $1.2 million, you can move there for less than half of the amount. So why wouldn't you? Especially if you are on fixed income. And when you consider the fact that housing could go up by $180,000 a year and you can't get into this market, that's a place where it screams opportunity. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Calgary maintains its position as the real estate darling of Canada for maybe the next couple of years. And it has largely to deal with affordability, right?
Yeah, or the lack of affordability in the other provinces that are just pushing people out of there by necessity.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And the last thing we want to touch on today is in regards to debt, because debt speaks a lot to what's going to happen in the upcoming economy here. And Equifax, has just come out with a statement stating that the credit card balances across Canada have hit an all-time high, eclipsing $107 billion in the second quarter of 2023. And this is obviously a sign that the financial stress is continuing to build in the face of inflation and, of course, our rising interest rates. The agency also came out and stated that Canadian consumer debt reached $2.4 trillion in the second quarter. I mean, if you divide that by every citizen in the country here, you're looking at about $60,000 per head. Not a small number here, and we know how indebted this country is. But shifting a bit here, if we look at the non-mortgage debt per credit active consumer, so that means if you looking outside of mortgages, if you have $1 or more in credit, credit cards, line of credit, etc., that is up as well, averaging $21,000 per person who have any type of credit out there. So even at, let's say, a $2,000 payment per month, that would take about a year to repay off, including some interest there, probably a little bit longer. Interestingly, though, despite this mounting credit card debt, delinquencies are not rising as fast as expected. So, I mean, ultimately, sure, people are probably paying their minimums at a minimum, so they're not delinquent yet. But again, you can just see where this is trending, right? It's not getting better. And of course, suddenly those minimum payments will become too much as well as the interest payments on your mortgages, et cetera, become more expensive as your groceries are more expensive. So that is an area of the industry that we're obviously watching, because of course, once that cracks, it can trickle, or it does trickle down into, of course, further spending and housing. Now, I guess the question is here, is it all doom and gloom? You know, this has been a longer than average episode, and we really appreciate you making it this far. But yeah, ultimately, like, you know, is this thing all about to fall apart and it's over? You know, again, like we touched on earlier, for those wanting to get into the market in a couple of years and the prices have gone up 360K, no, that's definitely some doom. That makes your life harder. If you're a homeowner and your property has gone up 180K per year for the next 6 years, maybe you're okay with that because you've got equity to tap into. It really depends, I guess, what side of the housing market coin you're in. But also, you know, we've got people that are basically just hanging on right now, and we're probably going to start to see these delinquencies rise. When will the reprieve come? We don't know. A statement that I heard the other day really stood out, and that it was in regards to interest rates. And it says Bank of Canada typically takes the stairs up when it comes to rates, but they'll take the elevator down. So let's keep in mind, you know, while we have no idea when or how much the next rate cut will be, if ever, but yeah, likely coming soon. And by soon, I mean within the next year. You know, it could be a dramatic reduction, right? Just like we saw in COVID, these things can change dramatically. So, you know, there is potential help along the way, but lots can happen between now and then. I don't know, Ryan, what's your take? Is it all doom and gloom out there right now?
I think it could feel like that. Yes. I think if it depends on where you're looking. I think the other thing that maybe this kind of spells is that if drastic action isn't taken, then yeah, it's going to be doomy and gloomy, and you're going to see, you know, I would think a further reduction of the middle class and more of a have and have not society, which is not good. I mean, the strength of any true economy, of any powerhouse economy, is the strength of its middle class. And right now, they're the ones that are being pummeled the most. So, you know, if that doesn't change, I mean, kind of housing aside, as a holistic environment for, you know, Canadian families to live in, you know, we need to see some dramatic reform. What's gotten us here, you know, it's not going to continue getting us to where we need to be as a society. So I think, you know, we need to see some changes. I you know, I do think that we can change things relatively quickly if we put our minds to it. But we need a collective change, right? And we're just a little too far down one way, but we can recover from this. So it's not all doom and gloom, so long as massive action takes place over the next few years.
Fantastic. Appreciate your outlook on this. And everybody, if you made it this far, longer than average episode, that's awesome. There was a ton to talk about this week, so we appreciate you sticking around. Hope you enjoyed it. As a reminder, please share it with one person that you know might enjoy it too. And we look forward to seeing you again next week.
That wraps up this edition of the Vancouver Life Podcast.
For more information on this podcast and to access a ton of free downloads, investment opportunities, current market info, and homes for sale, you can find it all at www.thevancouverlife.com.
Thanks, and we look forward to bringing you more podcasts about Vancouver real estate.